It's Saturday, the 4th of June, 2016. Happy birthday to Greg Munro. The Red Rock Basketball Monster Show, brought to you by Fantrax and Hoop Oracle. My name is Josh Lloyd, and for today's podcast, we're eschewing ourselves from the regular programming of season in review shows, and we're going to be looking at the 2016 NBA Draft. And to look at the 2016 NBA Draft, I'm joined by Sam Vecini of CBS Sports. Sam, how are you going?
Oh, I'm going great, Josh. How are you doing?
I'm going pretty well. Now, Sam, as many of you would know, is an NBA draft and college basketball writer over at CBS Sports, one of the best in the business. And also, Sam, you are the Essendon Bombers' biggest Los Angeles-based supporter, I believe.
Oh, I don't know. I think my girlfriend might disagree with that. I don't know if she counts, though. She's from Melbourne, so, I mean, maybe American Los Angeles-based, but I can live with the moniker nonetheless, even during this time of hardship.
Yeah, it's not a great time for Essendon supporters. I think the first time I saw you start tweeting about Australian football, I was a bit thrown off, and didn't really know what to make of it. Then it was coming, just heaps of tweets coming out, and quite knowledgeable stuff. And I was like, what's going on? And then yeah, I spoke to you a couple of tweets back, a few years back, telling me about how your girlfriend was from Melbourne, and it started to make more sense. But it's always a bit jarring when you see these football tweets coming from people based in the States, and you think, what is going on here? But hey, the more that we can grow, more that we can grow our game over there, it's better for us as well.
Oh no, I love it. I was just at a AFL combine over here for a college basketball player. Out for AFL ones that, you know, probably aren't really professional basketball players overseas or anything. It was a blast seeing these kids that have never picked up a footy at all, just try and kick it around and punch it around and, you know, just beat the crap out of each other going up for jump balls and stuff. It was great.
That must have been that's the one that Mason Cox, who's who was a college basketball player, and he's playing over here in the AFL now. He must have been in that last year, I'd say.
Yeah, Matt Korchek, who plays for Carlton's VFL team now, was over there last year. A couple guys are going to go over to, I want to say maybe Melbourne or Sydney this year to, you know, go and check it out for AFL teams and live over there for, I think, 2 months or so and just really give it a full-on go. So it's going to be pretty fun to see, and I'll be paying attention to them for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I don't think many people want to hear us talk about college basketball to AFL transition. They're more interested in us talking about college basketball to NBA transition. So that's what we've got you on here for. We're a couple of weeks out from the NBA draft. Now, you've been studying this stuff for a lot longer than I have. You've got your eye clearly on college basketball all season. So you're the best person to go to when we have these discussions. I think that the number one discussion that everyone's having, and it feels pretty clear-cut at the moment to me, but I want to hear your take on it. Ben Simmons versus Brandon Ingram. At pick number one, it feels very likely the Sixers are leaning towards Simmons.
Yeah, I think that that's the right read on it. All of the signals out of Philadelphia kind of point to that being the case, not only in terms of, you know, just the relationship that Brett Brown has with the Simmons family and just Brian Colangelo coming in and kind of wanting to win now more than later, and them looking to trade Nerlens Noel and Jahlil Okafor, likely to make space for Brandon Ingram or Ben Simmons as opposed to Brandon Ingram, who could play with both of those guys. It does seem like they're going to go with Simmons. I have Simmons as the number one player on my board. He's been that since, I want to say, November or so. So I did have Scalabissier at number one at one point. That didn't really go all that well for me. Simmons is a guy who can really become an all-star level player. I mean, how many guys at 6'10" can you see that that can do all of the things that he can do? He can take it, rip and run off the glass, and he's a great passer. He's a great slasher toward the rim, draws fouls, finishes around the rim with both hands. There's just so much to like about Ben at this point, and he's nearly, I don't want to say he's a finished product, but he's certainly a lot closer to contributing in the NBA than Brandon Ingram is.
I think this seems to happen, and correct me if I'm wrong, but with people who are built up as this is the number one guy, and Simmons has been built up as the number one guy for probably two or three seasons, but the more the players are built up, and for longer periods of time they are, the more people find holes to pick in their game and try to, you know, or maybe he's not number one. And we talk, hear the talk about he's got no jump shot. Sure, he only took 3 3-point attempts all season, and that's a concern. But then you hear that the character concern. He gives up. He gives up on his team. He doesn't try. Is that real, or is that something that is easily fixed, or is that just a case of people looking for negatives to really pick at his game when he should really clearly be the number one guy without much doubt?
You know, the game stuff I think is legitimate. Like the fact that he can't shoot is a problem, especially in today's NBA. Yeah, you kind of like the stuff he can do laterally. He's going to be able to switch to a lot of different guys. He's going to be able to make plays and play within a team concept, and that's all great. But at some point, you need to have the threat of a jump shot at the very least. And he doesn't really have that yet. It's developable, but you really need to just trust him at this stage to get there. And his defense wavers. I think the fact that he quit on that LSU team is a little bit more of a statement on that LSU team than it is on him, probably. That staff kind of enabled him. And, you know, like you said, being a, you know, number one overall pick projected for the last, you know, 2 to 3 years, I think that that kind of wore on Simmons and kind of made him, I'm trying to think of the way to put this, just a little bit into himself maybe, and kind of a guy who thought that maybe he didn't have to work as hard at his game and improving the weaknesses of his game than he probably does, because he's genuinely still a guy that has some problems to his game that he needs to address. In terms of the stuff about like his maturity and about, you know, is he the kind of guy you want to tie your championship hopes to as a franchise, I think some of it's pretty legitimate. I mean, I've talked to some people over there in Australia that both that around his age and around, you know, coaching age, that do question him in terms of his, I almost want to say Australianness, you know, like Australian culture is so, it's so Matthew Dellavedova. It's so hardcore and intense, and go all out at all times, including in practice and in games in every single circumstance. Once Ben moved over here to America around, I want to say 14 or 15, I guess that people could see a little bit of a change in terms of his demeanor. And that's kind of something that's interesting to track, you know, is that going to be something that follows him to the NBA and continues to be a thing that people notice? Or is it just a circumstance that, you know, maybe some people are looking for things negative about him, and some people are trying to, I guess, discuss him in a negative light or try to find the weakness in his game. I think that there are weaknesses enough beyond that, and you should at least take some of this with a grain of salt, but some of it as a legitimate concern. As far as what I think that once he gets into the pros, his desire to be a great player, like anytime you hear him talk, he wants to be one of the greats. I think that that's going to take over. I don't know if he can reach that level necessarily in terms of like being a top 50 player of all time or whatever, but I do think that his desire to be great is going to overshadow all of the questions about his maturity.
Yeah, I seem to think that way as well from stuff that I've heard and stuff that I've seen. And that point you brought up about the Australian-ness, I think that's part of the reason why I wanted to ask that question, because to have a guy come over as an Australian, like it seems like a very foreign concept to us to be someone who gives up. And I'm not saying that that's something that's, you know, perverse throughout the rest of the world, but you know, Australian players, Australian sportsmen, we're generally very aggressive in that sort of sense, and it just seemed like a weird character trait to be associated with him. And look, and definitely things didn't go well towards the end of the season at LSU, but I do have faith, and maybe that's that's, you know, Australian homerism or patriotism coming through, the thinking he's not like this, and he will be a guy that actually fights through things when he knows that this is what he's got to do, rather than like, what else am I doing at LSU? I know that I'm out of here at the end of the year. This team is garbage. This coach doesn't know what he's doing. You know, I'm focusing on other things now. And that's the sort of way I looked at it. And it's interesting to hear your take on that as well. Now, before we get on to the next.
Yeah, no, I think that what you bring up is really interesting. I do wonder if like the that Australian-ness is going to take over in a few ways. You know, maybe it does. Maybe it's just dormant in there. I think that coming in, a lot of people expected that from him this year. He kind of had that benefit of the doubt, given the way Australians have had success in terms of basketball recently in the way that they've had success in terms of basketball recently. But it just didn't work out that way, and maybe it will work out going forward.
He's also the most talented Australian basketballer that we've had pretty much ever. So there's a little bit of difference between him and Patty Mills or Dellavedova or Bogut. Not saying those guys aren't talented, but Simmons is the highest ranked prospect that we've really ever had come across. So I think there's a little bit of a difference there in terms of those guys having to fight through everything. And he sort of was knowing that I'm going to be a top draft pick for the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, no, I mean, you even look at Andrew Bogut. Bogut went number one overall in the draft, and I want to say 2006?
Yeah, maybe, six,
2004,
I think.
Or something like that, 2006. It wasn't a situation where he was going into the year assuming that he was going to be the number one overall pick. And in his sophomore and junior years, yeah, he was expected to develop and, you know, eventually probably be a first round pick. But his senior year, he really came on when he was 22 years old, you know. So it's a totally different thing for Simmons, who has been hyped up since he was 16, 17 years old, who has come to America at that age, who has, you know, dealt with the AAU system of hyping and overhyping, and then the overreaction to the hype, and then the overreaction to the overreaction of the hype. I mean, it's a ridiculous cycle that I think we're seeing with Thon Maker right now in this draft. And Simmons is obviously way more talented than Thon, and I think that we've seen that throughout the course of their careers. But it's just going to be really interesting to see how this thing goes and what way it ends up playing out.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't wait to see it. Now, Sam, before we get into the next part, I just want to have a quick word from our sponsor for today's show, and that is Fantrax. And if Sam, if you aren't aware of Fantrax, Fantrax is a great site for hosting fantasy leagues. It's the most customizable fantasy sports site, much more customizable than any of the other ones out there. Not to disparage your great employers, CBS, but Fantrax offers fantastic customization in their free leagues, and of course their premium leagues offers everything. All of the Red Rock listener leagues are going to be hosted at Fantrax this season. We hosted a massive Red Rock Dynasty League there last year, which rostered over 400 players. We can have player salaries introduced into the league. We have contracts. There's great depth, minor league squads, all this sort of stuff. And you can all check that out at Fantrax.com. And think about taking your league over there. It does it for all 9 major sports, including some that aren't quite so major. And you might not think they have fantasy leagues like golf and NASCAR. They do college basketball, college football, football, baseball, basketball, hockey, everything you can think of over at Fantrax. So go and check them out and give it a whirl, because once you go and check through their options, you'll be surprised at how many different customization options there are. And I think you'll spend quite a few hours going through it and setting your league up over there. Now, we've talked a lot on Simmons, Sam. Brandon Ingram's the guy who's almost guaranteed to go two, if he doesn't for some reason go one. You hear the talk about him and Kevin Durant. I think a lot of it is, well, to me, I think a lot of it's just based on the way he looks on the court, with just the long arms, the lankiness, the shooting. Is there anything else that sort of potentially looks Kevin Durantish, or is that just a lazy comparison?
Well, I do think it's a pretty lazy comparison, but the shooting, the length, I mean, that's where it comes from. And you have to remember that Brandon is still like 2 inches shorter than Kevin Durant, who I do believe is 7 feet tall, regardless of what he says and what he's listed at. Brandon's a really good player. He is one of the smoother players you'll find. He's a really good scorer in isolation. Once you get him the ball at the high post or at the three-point line, he can attack off the dribble in a straight line. He can spin back. And he has a really nice step-back jumper in terms of just using those long legs that he has, because, I mean, not only does he have a long wingspan, but with his game, particularly with that step back jumper, he's just a long limbed person. He can get that space against anyone because of those long legs that he has, and can knock down those 18 foot jumpers, 20 foot jumpers, and efficiently score in isolation in a way that many people can't. In terms of what I think he could work on, I do think that he is still a little bit less athletic than he's getting credit for in a lot of ways. Not to say that he's a bad athlete or anything, but I think that the length often kind of masks explosiveness in a lot of ways with him. And once he continues to put on weight and put on muscle mass, which will happen in the NBA, he does have a skinny frame, and you do have to worry about him putting it on properly and efficiently. But once he puts it on, I do think there's a chance for him to unlock a little bit of explosiveness, but there's always the chance that he kind of is what he is in terms of that, and maybe won't be as efficient a finisher around the rim as a guy like Paul George, who ended up becoming a bit more explosive, or Giannis Antetokounmpo, who coming into the draft was actually noted for a bit of a lack of explosiveness, but now is a relatively strong athlete in terms of how he gets up toward the rim. So Ingram is just a little bit more of an unknown quantity because of his frame and his body, and he's still so dependent on the way that body continues to develop. And you have to remember too, he's a year younger than Ben Simmons, like a full year and I think 2 months, 3 months, something like that. So their developmental cycles are a little bit different here. Simmons is going to be 20 for his first rookie year. Brandon is going to be 19 for that rookie year. It gives you that extra year of leeway in terms of Brandon's, you know, development and the way that his body is going to go. But I think that Brandon Ingram, more than anything, is just kind of perfect for the way the modern NBA is going. You can knock down shots. You can switch him onto four different positions defensively, and he'll really care. He's tough. He really, really goes up and isn't afraid of contact despite that lack of strength. So I think that he's going to be fine. I think he has all-star potential. I just don't know that he is necessarily like this hyper elite prospect that many have said, even with the way the modern NBA is going.
Yeah, I think that ties in with everything that I've seen of him and everything I've heard about him as well. He's obviously very thin, but there's ways that can go. Giannis came in, as you said, like extraordinarily thin, and now he's an absolute monster when you look at him, but yeah. There are players who don't put on weight. So there's, and he's only 18, so there's ways that can go. So it really depends on, I guess, in genetics that we don't necessarily have access to see how able his body is to put that weight on, but or it could just go the other way and just be someone who can't actually get that weight happening. Yeah, much like Kevin Durant, who's never really developed huge arms. He's definitely not a Giannis or a Serge Ibaka in terms of biceps or shoulder size. He's just more that long, thin, lanky type of player. Now, after the
absolutely. I think that you kind of nailed that perfectly. It's just a question. I think that teams might have a little bit better of an idea as we do as far as genetics. They'll probably look as far back as they can into his family tree and see if there has been some sort of circumstance with some late blooming in terms of muscle mass. But it's something that I'm not going to take the time to look into because I'm a little bit busy.
You need a degree in genealogy to get back that far. Now, the top two, it's been a long time. It's a two-player draft. But after that, it feels like to me that there's just a group of players who it's really hard to separate them. Maybe three, four, maybe six, seven guys who you could realistically think this guy could go three, this guy could go number four. Do you see that as the way it is, or is there sort of more distinct tiers of players that sit there? Like, oh, this guy is definitely the third or fourth best, or could you see a range of six or seven guys going in the three to four slot?
I mean, in terms of the way that I see it, personally, I do think that there is a bit of a drop-off after Dragan Bender and Chris Dunn. But teams don't see it that way necessarily. And I don't want to say I would be surprised if either of those two went to the Celtics, because Danny Ainge loves himself some athletic guards, and Dragan Bender's perfect fit for what they want in terms of stretching the floor and, providing versatility in their front court for Brad Stevens. But I think it's possible they go with, Jaylen Brown, Marquise Chris. I would be a little bit surprised if they went with Jamal Murray, but those guys are all kind of in that tier at this point. Buddy Hield is another guy that's kind of in that next tier at this point. So it's going to be really interesting to see that the way this kind of breaks out, because from, I would say, number three to number 10 or so right now, there's a lot of fluidity. Like, even from team to team, there's a lot of fluidity. That's what makes building one, like what I do in terms of like my big board, so difficult right now, because some teams really like Marquise Chris, some teams really don't like him. They think he's just fine in terms of his explosiveness is great, his shooting is great, but he doesn't really know how to play basketball yet. So that's kind of a problem. Some teams care about more about feel, some teams care more about upside, and that depends on what kind of picks you have in this draft. The Celtics have 3 picks. They can afford to take maybe a few more risks. The Suns have 3 picks. They can afford to take a few more risks. But the Timberwolves probably want to hit on this pick so that they can build around Karl Anthony Towns and Andrew Wiggins, because they maybe might not be at number 5 again for, you know, 5 or 6 years. So they're probably a little bit more set on wanting to go for more of a sure thing. It's just a fascinating draft in terms of the way this thing is going to go down. And I don't really think that anyone knows how that number 3 to number 10 range is going to break out yet.
Yeah, I agree in terms of just the intrigue in this draft. And we've been hearing for so long, it's such a weak draft, but it doesn't take away any of the intrigue or the talent level of some of these players. They might not end up being, you know, groups of, you know, 5-6 all-stars out of this group, but there's going to be players who are key contributors. And this, you've got in your latest mock draft, you've got Bender at 3. He's the guy that I think at 3. But you've seen other ones. There's multiple players that they've got at 3. Brown is on. Marquise Chris jumped up to number 3 on a mock draft somewhere I saw the other day, which was a bit out of the blue to me. And as you said, he's just got tons of athletic potential, but does that translate into anything? So there's lots of options. We talked about, well, you mentioned all these guys, Chris Dunn, Jamal Murray, Buddy Hield. It's probably the 3 top guard prospects on the board. Now, Jamal Murray, we saw what he did in Kentucky in terms of shooting the 3. He hit a lot of 3s, but he played off the ball. But his position, it's mainly as a point guard, correct? That's how he played before he went to Kentucky. And that seems to happen a lot to guys at Kentucky. They have to play out of position or out of their role. We saw Carl Anthony Towns play a different role last year. We saw Trey Lyles play out of position last year. And we saw Murray this year. Does he translate to you to be someone a team's going to be picking as a point guard or as a combo guard or as strictly a shooting guard?
I think that Jamal Murray is a 2 guard that can handle the ball a little bit, right? Like, I've never been in on this Jamal Murray point guard thing. I know that he played point guard throughout his younger days and until he turned right around 17. Even at the Nike Hoop Summit, he was mostly playing shooting guard in both of the years that he was there. He's 6'5" with a 6'7" wingspan. He has fine height and length to play the shooting guard. He's not necessarily the most explosive athlete, so I wonder if he's going to be able to get the separation you need to be able to play point guard. He's a guy that you want coming off of screens, attacking off of catch and shoot situations, or maybe attacking a closeout once or twice to get into the lane and make plays with his passing ability that he didn't really get to show off this year because at Kentucky, their spacing was horrible. He was their only real shooter outside of Derek Willis, who didn't really come on until late in the year. So it's going to be difficult, I think, for Murray to play just the full point guard. But we've seen the Timberwolves, for instance, play Zach LaVine at the it didn't help him in the long run in terms of his development. So Murray to me is at his best a 2 that attacks closeouts, but I could see him being successful in spurts as like kind of a combo guard that handles.
Now, Chris Dunn is pretty much universally regarded as the best point guard in this class. He is obviously an older player. As we've seen a few, we don't often see many seniors find their way into the top 10, but we're going to see at least a couple this season. Dunn has some of the other concerns that some of the other players, like Simmons, his shooting, his jump shot is not quite up to scratch. Does his age scare teams off? Does his lack of jump shot scare teams off as a point guard? Or is his defensive ability, his passing ability, make him that sort of top echelon prospect?
In terms of Chris Dunn, I'm not sure that the age necessarily scares teams off, just because if you've seen him at Providence, he's still developing in a lot of ways. Like, he's never really he missed his first 2 seasons at Providence due to shoulder injuries. I think that might be the biggest concern about Chris Dunn at this stage, or the shoulder injury is going to recur. And in terms of that, I'm not really sure if there have been any discoveries, because he didn't go through the medical at the combine. It seems like his agency, CAA, is going to try and hold back that information as much as possible. In terms of the worries about his game, yeah, the jump shot's a little bit of a concern, but it seems like he's been improving in that regard, at least off of the catch. And he's always been a relatively solid mid-range jump shooter. And he needs to kind of, I would say, chill some of the wilder tendencies in his game. He can get a little bit out of control from time to time and, you know, look to make the spectacular play instead of the right play. And I think that teams like the fact that he makes the spectacular play often, but they're going to want him to tone down some of the more questionable aspects of his game. But to me, you still have a kid that is incredibly athletic. He's huge. I mean, if you've ever seen him in person, this kid is just like a house at the point guard position. It's not like a Marcus Smart situation because he's a little bit more skinny strong than Smart, but he battles nonstop. He's a great defender. He has great vision. He can attack the rim with his quickness and his explosiveness. I really think that Chris Dunn is a potential all-star. That's why I have him at number three on my big board right now. And he is just, to me, a lot of what NBA teams are going to be looking for in the point guard position going forward.
Now we've got Dunn, who's a senior, and we've got Buddy Hield, who's a senior as well. But to me, the difference between those two guys as seniors is that Dunn, if he was to have declared for the draft last season, there was a chance that he was going to be a lottery pick. Hield wasn't in that conversation at all, but took a huge step forward. And that says a lot about Buddy Hield's work ethic and his ability to improve his game. But does that fact that he really only started to break out as a senior and started to beat up on these younger kids, does that detract from his performance, and does that cause you some concern about how he actually translates to the NBA, where instead of him beating up on players, there'll be players beating up on him?
I don't know that beat up is necessarily the right term with Buddy, just because of the nature of his game.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
he's more of a finesse player. You know what I mean? He's going to kind of take those step back jumpers to the left side. Like, he always tries to get to the left side with his left hand and then take a crossover and shoot while he's gathering from the left side as opposed to the right side. He's going to just knock down these jump shots off of offensive rebounds, hit them, you know, all over the place. He was one of the best shooters in college basketball history last season. In terms of what to expect from Buddy going forward, though, I do think that it's a little bit of a concern that his developmental cycle didn't really improve in terms of his body while he was at Oklahoma over the course of the last three seasons. Yeah, he got naturally stronger and naturally fitter in terms of his conditioning, but I mean, there was no real change in terms of that. And you do wonder if he's kind of just hit his ceiling at this stage, right? Like, is he just this incredible shooter that can attack a closeout off the dribble, but isn't necessarily the best ball handler, isn't necessarily the best passer, and has shown the ability to defend before, but you know, is going to need some time to adjust defensively at the next level. So I do have Buddy, you know, kind of a tier below the Chris Dunn, Dragon Bender level. I have him right below Jamal Murray on my big board. I have Buddy at number seven, or number eight at this stage. I think that there's a lot to like about Buddy. I just think that maybe we're looking at more of like a JJ Redick impact, which is awesome. I mean, JJ dropped like 16 points, 4 assists a game or something this year, and he's really developed over the course of his, you know, decade-long career. But maybe you're looking more in that range than potential all-star.
Yeah, Redick's the guy that when I see Buddy that I sort of compare him to because of the way that their games are. But yeah, I also think that he's not the player that you take. You know, you don't take him ahead of Dunn. You don't take him ahead of Murray. In my opinion, I'm glad that your opinion equals out with what I think on that. It makes me feel a little bit better than that. Now, in terms of your overall big board, is there a player that you find yourself that you're consistently higher on than other people are?
That's a really interesting one. I would say that the guy I'm consistently lower than people on is probably Marquese Chriss, as we've discussed. I have him at number 14 right now, as opposed to, you know, some people have him at like number six. Some people have him like potentially going as top three pick. You know, that's just not something I'm ever going to get to. I totally get the appeal of a guy like Marquese Chriss. It's just not going to happen. In terms of a guy that I'm higher on than most, though, maybe Tyler Ulis at Kentucky. I mean, I do kind of tend to fall in love with these guys that, you know, will demand respect immediately from NBA teams because it's so incredibly rare. I think Bobby Portis is one of those guys last year. He ended up going maybe number 20, number 21, something like that, to Chicago. I had him at like number 12 on my big board because I just kind of saw that, you know, his intensity was going to be one of those things that veterans on that team really loved. And Ulis is the same boat for me. I mean, Tyler is a coach on that floor, genuinely. Like more than anyone in college basketball over the last few years, that term applies to him. He genuinely had to teach all of these freshmen and inexperienced guys how to play basketball this year at Kentucky, and that's an incredibly difficult thing to do. He had to kind of create all of their offense because Jamal Murray wasn't necessarily as efficient as you would hope off the dribble. He had to really defend at the point of attack because their defense wasn't as great as anticipated, and he ended up winning SEC Defensive Player of the Year. And, you know, one thing that really stands out to me is this thing that my buddy John Gavoni over at Draft Express tweeted out last year at the draft. He said that an NBA team asked every single Kentucky player, all seven of them that were at the combine last year, who is the guy that you most would want to go to war with in terms of playing on the floor? And the answer was unanimously Tyler Ulis. So I think that says a lot about his character. I think it says a lot about how hard he's going to work. He's not a perfect player. I mean, he's 149 pounds, for God's sake. Like, it's going to be difficult for him to deal with the strength of the next level and the rigors of the next level. But I just think that he's going to figure it out. He's going to demand respect, and he's just going to be one of those guys that makes it work.
You feel like he's going to be a guy that just demands a role. Now, whether that's a role as a starter or a role as a backup point guard who comes in and plays like a, you know, 20 minutes a night throughout the course of his career, but mm-hmm. his sort of tenacity and his defense is going to keep him in the NBA for, it feels like, a pretty long amount of time. Yeah, looking at your big board now, you've got him at number 16, but the guy you've got above him and the guy you've got below him are two players that really intrigue me. You've got Timothy Luwawu. Is that how we say it?
Luwawu, yeah.
Luwawu. It's a tough one. I always want to go say Luwawu, but it's Luwawu. You've got him above him, and you've got Wade Baldwin, the fourth, below him. I'll start with Luwawu. Obviously, he's coming across from France, but he intrigues me as one of the better international prospects coming across outside of Bender. But his ability to play as a 3-and-D wing defender, which we know in the NBA that's so highly sought after, what's your take on Luwawu? Can he sneak himself into the lottery, or how much can he develop? Have you seen much of him?
I mean, I've watched a ton of him on tape. Luwawu is a really interesting guy in that, you know, the idea of Luwawu on internet draft boards seems to be just a little bit higher than where NBA teams rank him at this stage. They're all over the board on him, actually. I mean, some teams do think that he's like a late lottery value. Other teams think he's more of a late first round value. And the reason for that is that there's a lot to like about him athletically. He's long. You know, he does care defensively, but there's some questions in terms of, is his handle going to be good enough, and is it going to develop enough? He is already 21 years old. Is the shot going to translate? It's a streaky shot right now with a little bit of a low release point. So I think there are some questions as to whether or not that's going to, you know, kind of go over to the NBA well. And there are some questions about his frame right now, too, in terms of, is he a little bit too skinny to consistently defend the bigger threes of the NBA, or to defend like a guy like a Harrison Barnes, even at like 6'7", 6'8", 230 pounds or whatever? Because Luwawu is still really skinny, has a really skinny frame, and he's more of a two guard right now, to be honest, than a three. Some teams wonder if he's just kind of in that no man's land between, you know, you want a two guard to be able to handle the ball and do a lot of different things, and you want your threes to kind of be big enough to defend threes and fours and twos and everything. So I do think he's a really interesting guy in terms of just the athleticism and the fact that the shot might translate and he really might be a perfect 3-and-D guy. But in terms of where he goes, it's kind of all over the place right now. I'm not sure. I mean, maybe late lottery is where he goes. Maybe a team like Utah really likes him because they need an athletic wing to go next to Rodney Hood and Gordon Hayward. Maybe a team, maybe he falls down to, I don't know, like, who's 23. I think it's the Celtics who would really like him because might be able to stash him for a year, and they have 8 picks in this draft. So he's kind of all over the board right now. It wouldn't surprise me to see him fall or to rise at this stage, which I think kind of says a lot about this draft and the unpredictability of it right now.
Now, you said you watch a lot of tape on him, so you must be fully aware of the exciting colours of the Megalex uniforms, which you would have had burnt into your retinas for all that time watching them. They are something.
I love it.
It's so interesting to see it out there, but it's jarring at first to just watch fluorescent pink and fluorescent green, you know, top on shorts get out there, and you think, what am I watching? But then you keep watching it, and it just really... It's very standout-ish, I think is the best way of putting it. I like what Luwawu was able to do with his assist numbers. He averaged 2.8 assists per game last year, which is something that, it's not a massive amount, but for a guy that's playing, you know, in a European league as a wing, like it's a fair amount of playmaking. Is that something that could translate, do you think?
It's definitely something that's gotten a lot better this year. Maybe we'll be able to translate, but I think that he needs to develop as a ball handler first so that once he gets to the NBA against these better athletes, he's able to get into the lane and make those plays for other guys, right? I think that that's a little bit of a question at this stage. As long as the ball handling comes along, though, I think you're right. He does have the kind of vision that you're hoping for from a role-playing wing that will always make the right pass instead of, you know, trying to do it all himself, which he can occasionally get himself into trouble doing this year at Megalex. But it's going to be fun to watch, I would say, the way that he's going to develop and the way that he ends up playing here in America.
Now, the other guy that I wanted to talk about there who was behind Ulis was Wade Baldwin. Now, he measured in with a ridiculous wingspan of, I think, 6'11 and a half, which is just huge for a guy that's his height, which is 6'4". Defensively, that's obviously going to be a key part of what he does. Now, he was a point guard at Vanderbilt, but I've heard some people thinking that he's not quite a point guard. He's more of a two. How do you view Baldwin, and how do you view his game? Is he an offensive negative enough that keeps him off the court, considering his defensive plus side, or has he got a lot of potential to work with offensively as well?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting question. I think that if he's successful in his career, he's going to be more of a point guard than a two. Last year, coming into the year, he's someone that I wrote about pretty extensively because he was one of the only freshmen in the country last year to put up like an assist rate over 30, a rebounding rate over like 15, and a true shooting percentage over like 57 or something like that, something along those numbers. He kind of just did it all last year in a lot of ways for Vanderbilt. This year, yeah, he took a little bit of a step forward just because of his role being a little bit bigger at Vanderbilt, but there were some problems, I would say. He didn't really make as many strides as you would hope for in terms of his, you know, ball handling. He's still not a guy that is going to change pace all that often or is going to go side to side. He's a downhill guy. That's why you might have heard like the name Russell Westbrook come up with him, just because Russ plays so downhill. You know, Wade plays that downhill. He's just not nearly as athletic as Russ is. And that's not a, bad thing to say about Wade. It's just he's not Russell Westbrook, and you know, it's okay to not be Russell Westbrook.
No one's as athletic as Russell Westbrook.
Exactly, no one's Russell Westbrook, so it's fine. I do think that Wade will find a role in the NBA, be it just because of that length. He's going to be able to switch 1 to 3 relatively easily with the way defenses are going. He's going to be able to make plays for others, and his ability to shoot off the dribble and off the catch, you know, some people do question it, but his numbers are really good in college. So I think that he'll figure that out at some point as well. So really, I think that Wade will find a way. I don't really see the star potential necessarily, because I don't think he's athletic enough to be a downhill guy nonstop, and I don't really think he has enough wiggle in his game yet to kind of get to where he needs to go. But having said that, you know, he's going to find a way to make it work in the NBA at the very least. I just don't know that it's going to be quite as high as some people expect. Having said that, I do think that even though I have him below Tyler Ulis on my board, I think he will be the second point guard taken in the draft.
Yeah, I think that's I'm hearing well, you're seeing his draft range being from 10 to 28. There's lots, and that's basically the theme of this draft, is that once we get out of that first little bit, that guys are all over the place. But I think I tend to agree with you. I think he goes in that late lottery sort of section. I'm a Bulls fan, so at pick 14, I'm really looking at Baldwin and Luwawu as two guys that we might be considering there as well. So that's something that intrigues me there. Jaylen Brown.
One thing with Luwawu is you kind of have a Luwawu and Tony Snell, which is scary. because, you know, Tony Snell's Tony Snell.
he is Tony Snell.
You do have that, you have that skinny, you know, 6 foot six guy, 6 foot seven guy with long arms that, you know, you hope develops as a shooter, but never really has. I mean, that's kind of a perfect example, a microcosm of the downside of Timothy Luwawu, right?
Yep.
So it's a really interesting comparison to want him at 14, in my opinion, just because of Tony Snell. I do agree with you, though. I think that he's easily a guy that they could look at just because they do need someone like that, because Tony's not getting the job done.
No, he hasn't really shown anything at all, Tony Snell, but we're not here to have a Tony Snell symposium. Jaylen Brown, we've talked about him a little bit earlier. Now, some of the criticisms that are coming out, which is, it's weird to me, but I can sort of understand the criticisms, is that he's too intelligent, that he's too much of a free thinker, too much of a questioner. Is that a real concern, or is that one of those things that's just brought up as, you know, just media, not media, but I can't think of the right way to phrase it. It just sounds like bullshit. Well, it sounds like bullshit to me.
It's the kind of thing general managers would say, yep, to media, right? In terms of whether or not it matters, that's kind of a complicated question. For some teams, I think that it kind of will a little bit. I think that the fact that he's intelligent, though, is more of a positive than a negative. It's just the inquisitive nature about the way that he goes about things. I mean, for instance, he's not hiring an agent to negotiate his first deal and to go through the pre-draft process. To me, that's crazy. Having seen, you know, the way that the logistics work for these major prospects in terms of going to workouts, like they'll probably have to go to 10 workouts. You have to arrange 25 flights, you know, back and forth to, you know, your workout facility, your next team after that. It's just a grueling, grueling process that I would not want to deal with. And I as a guy that is also having to work out and be on his mental game for all of these job interviews every single day of the week, I respect the fact that he's doing it, but that's the kind of free thinking that people talk about, right? The fact that he's willing to go about this differently. In terms of, you know, his draft stock, I do think that the intelligence is more of a positive than a negative, but some teams will see it in a light where they do not want to deal with the inquisitive nature of a player depending on their locker room, right? So I think that Boston at number three would be fine with it, with the way he is. I think teams with solid, settled locker rooms and solid, strong-minded coaches and front offices will be fine with it. It's more teams that are kind of still developing and are in a bit more of an uncertain place. You don't know if you want a guy that's going to be questioning the coach occasionally in that circumstance. So more than anything, I think his intelligence is positive because it shows emotional maturity. But I think for some teams, it'll be questioned and it will be dissected in a way to see if it's right for their specific situation.
Yeah, I think that's to me it's a positive as well, but I can understand the teams and certain situations might see it as an issue, especially teams, as you mentioned, with unstable situations or insecurities amongst players or coaching staff, mm-hmm, or general managers. It could be an issue. Now, Deontay Davis is probably a player who's going to go in that late lottery range. And if people don't know what his game's like, he's a rim protector, he's a rim runner, he's a shot blocker, he's just one of those down low sort of guys. But after him, who's the best sort of player in that mold, in that rim protector, rim runner sort of player? You've got guys like Cheick Diallo, Onuwaku. Mm-hmm. Who do you view as the next big, or is there someone you think is better than Davis in that sort of role?
Well, I think that you're going to see Scal Labissiere kind of have a role like that in the NBA, except Scal's also going to be able to pick and pop a little bit, right? Scal was a really good shot blocker this year. If he would have qualified minutes-wise, he would have been first in the SEC in block rate this year. He really does protect the weak side of the rim well. And like I said, he's a great shooter. That jump shot is one of the smoothest jump shots I've seen for a guy at 7 feet ever. It really is, and whether or not he's going to knock him down or not, whatever. But you have to assume that a shot like that is translatable. And obviously, if you're playing in the pick and roll and you're playing in the pick and pop, you're going to be able to rim run a little bit. You're going to be able to, kind of get a situation where a guy thinks you're going to pop and you're going to roll instead. I think that he would be the guy I would look at in the late lottery that can kind of do that. In terms of the lower end guys, yeah, Sheck Diallo is an interesting one. He's a guy that at, you know, 6'9", 6'10", has tremendously long arms, has one of the best motors in the draft, is one of the best transition big men that I've ever scouted. He is a gazelle in the front court and in the back court running, you know, either as a trailer or as a guy who's, you know, getting there with his teammate and his guard in the front court. So it's a, he's a really impressive guy, and he blocks shots, and, you know, he can switch like onto smaller players. I think that's a really valuable thing. But Davis is probably the best of that group. I think that you're right, just because he's strong, he's mobile, he rebounds, he rim protects, and has a little bit of a potential to shoot that jump shot.
Yeah, that's exactly the way I said. Davis is an intriguing athlete to me. He just looks like he can be maybe not DeAndre Jordan, but in a similar mold. Is that too high a bar to set?
I think it's a little bit of a different bar to set, maybe, because DeAndre is, you know, 7'1" with like a 7'6" wingspan and is just explosive beyond explosive, right? I don't see Deontay playing the center position the way that DeAndre does. I see him more as like a, maybe a Tristan Thompson-y kind of guy, where you can switch him out onto smaller players defensively. He can guard the pick and roll. He's going to get offensive rebounds. He's going to finish around the paint. Now that Tristan isn't like, you know, 19, 20 years old, because that was something that used to frustrate me with him all the time, was he used to get blocked all the time. But I think that the key with Davis is like, maybe he can develop that jump shot out to maybe 15 feet, because the semblance is there. He just needs to get it a little bit more consistent.
Now we're going to transition to a couple of European big men now, who always seem to be grouped together in big boards in mock drafts. They're always really close to each other. Ante Zizic and Ivica Zubac. Now, both of those guys, they seem to be projected around that, in that 20s range. They're both 19 years old. They're both big men, obviously, from Croatia. Zizic is a guy who's been a rebounding animal this season over. Now, he plays in the Adriatic League, I believe.
Yes.
And Zubac, and another one of the...
Sabona.
Yes, Sabona. And Zubac, another guy that plays for that Megalex color explosion. He's more of a shot-blocking guy. How do you view those two guys, or who translates better to coming across to the NBA? Are they both likely to come across, or is one more likely to stay in Europe?
Zizic's contract is such that he will probably be in Europe next year. Zubac is kind of a more interesting situation, because he had quite a trek throughout the year.
He sure did.
He got hurt early in the year. He was playing for that same Sabona team that, you know, Zizic is on early in the year, and then decided to go across town to Sativa, and, you know, he had problems with payment there, I guess, and ended up leaving, or maybe the payment was at Sabona. I'm not entirely sure. I don't really remember the exact details of it. And then he ended up not being affiliated with the team for a little while, and then ended up signing with Megalex, because his agent is a team that runs a lot of Megalex's players. Zubac is more of your traditional 7'1" center that can play in the low post and can play in the pick and roll and score, and he rebounds and he does all that. Zizic is your high energy guy that is just so competitive, and with a 7'3" wingspan, he just kind of jumps all over the place, and he's an athlete in motion, and he is a good pick and roll player. There's a lot to like about what Zizic can do. I do fall a little bit more toward the side of production in these situations than potential, just given that they're the same age. Zizic is a guy that I think I have a little bit higher than Zubac, but a lot of teams like Zubac a little bit better. It really is like close 1A, 1B in terms of the way that they'll go. And on draft night, they could go either way. It'll just depend on if a team wants a guy that maybe will come over immediately, or if they want a guy that they can stash for a year. You know, it's more of a team situation than a we take the best player available situation.
Zizic, I remember reading about him probably six or so months ago, and some of the comparisons to him were like a Yusuf Nurkic type of player. Do you see that sort of thing with him?
Nurkic was always a little bit more of a low post guy for me than Zizic. I think the comparison there might have been that Nurkic was incredibly productive in the Adriatic League. just in terms of their statistical acumen at that point. In terms of the way he plays, he's more of just like a high energy. I don't know if I want to compare him to like a Steven Adams necessarily, because I think Steven's a little bit better of an athlete and can move a little bit more in the pick and roll defensively and can switch out onto guys like we saw in the Western Conference Finals. But maybe that's kind of what you're thinking about, maybe a little bit worse of a Steven Adams in terms of he's always going to play hard, going to crash the glass, going to, you know, maybe eventually be mobile enough to defend out there, but probably not quite as well as Adams does.
Okay. Now, the next player I want to talk about is a player that you've got quite a fair way down on your big board, and I've seen him projected right over the place, and I think a lot of it is due to the unknown nature of it, and that is Zhao Qi. Is it Qi? Is that how I pronounce his surname? I've never heard his name actually pronounced.
Zhao Qi.
That's him, from China, the massive 7'2" center. We know that pretty much every prospect that comes out of China is 7 foot and above, given the way that they run their national sports program of funneling players who are tall into the basketball program, and that's where they put their resources. So we see a lot of big men coming from China. But how does he... You've got him down in the 40s on your big board. I've seen him, you know, be projected in the teens in certain drafts, but you know, other times in the second round. He's a very much an unknown prospect, but his measurables will get some teams excited, won't they, won't he?
Sure. I think that Zhou is one of the most difficult prospects in this draft to project. It's not because he is, you know, this mysterious guy that nobody's seen play. I mean, he's been playing professionally in the CBA now for 2 years. He's been productive in the CBA. It's just, how does that production translate to the next level given his body? If you've ever seen this dude in person, it really can't be overstated how thin he is. Thinner than like Brandon Ingram in terms of skinniness, like thinner than Kevin Durant was coming out of college. Like, this dude is thin, and he has to act as a rim protector, and he has to act as, you know, a guy that you're trusting to eventually develop as a guy who can, you know, rim run and do a lot of stuff that you want centers to do now. He's improved his strength throughout the year, but I just truly don't buy the body ever coming around in a way that like it has for Rudy Gobert, for instance, right? Like, Gobert always had those massive shoulders. And even though I wasn't super high on Rudy coming into the draft, I can see how that worked, right? He always had good hands. He always, you know, had the body that could fill out properly. With Zhou, I don't really see the hands all that great. He can shoot a little bit. He can step out and knock down like international line threes, but the release is slow. Like, everything he kind of does is just slow to me. Like, he wasn't all that impressive at Nike Hoop Summit when I saw him. It's possible that a team takes him in the first round, and it might be like somewhat ownership related, where it's just incredibly valuable for them to tap into the Chinese market. But I mean, on the floor, it's hard for me to see how that works in the NBA, just given the lack of strength.
Fair enough. I haven't seen really anything of him, so it's good to have get an opinion on how his game translates, because he's just massively tall, but the weight and the strength issue is a concern. Yeah. Now, we talked about...
And the long arms, too. Like, he's like a 7'7 wingspan, 7'8 wingspan. Like, it's... He has what you're looking for in terms of, like, height, length, from a rim protector. He has, like, Rudy Gobert height and length. It's just... I can't see it. I get it, and I think that, you know, maybe you take a flyer on him in the second round and it works out, but it's hard for me to get behind it just as a pure evaluator. It's hard for me to get, you know, to get behind him just due to the body.
We talked Timotei Luwawu before as a 3-and-D wing prospect. One guy who's a very interesting player to me is Malcolm Brogdon, who was one of the best perimeter defenders in college basketball last season. But he's a senior, so his upside is perhaps somewhat limited compared to others. And his offensive game is a concern from some of the things that I read and I've seen. But he did shoot 39% from three last season. How do you see Brogdon transitioning? Or is he just going to be that much of an issue offensively that he's going to be put into maybe a worse Tony Allen sort of role?
So I do have Malcolm Brogdon as a first-round prospect. I think I have him at like 26 or 27 on my board. Malcolm's always been kind of a guy that I've always been high on. Even last year, some guys like had him outside of their top 100 on their big board. I had him like at 55 or 60. This year, I have him as a first-rounder when very few people do. if you've ever met or talked to Malcolm Brogdon, you kind of just get it with him. Like, you get it that he gets it, right? Like, this kid is 23 years old, already has a master's degree, stayed in school last year because he wanted to go and get his master's degree from Virginia. He's tough. He is strong as all hell. If you ever shook in his hand literally swallows your hand if you are like a normal sized human. He is intelligent. He gets it in terms of the way that defenses attack and the way that he needs to improve his game. The problem with him, obviously, is the athleticism. He's always been a guy that's gotten by on craft more than skill, so to craft more than, you know, athletic skill, so to speak. And then some people question the jump shot as well, because while he does shoot effectively coming off of screens, and while he does shoot the 39% number from three, and he shot 42%, I believe, as a sophomore, the shot is relatively flat and has kind of a goofy release. So defender in college basketball last year, in my opinion, that competitive drive, that will to dominate your opponent, that's not leaving anytime soon. And I think that that's incredibly valuable at the next level. And I just can't see a way that he is not, at the very least, given the way he can kind of run the point occasionally, given the way that, you know, you would have to assume the jump shot, he'll work at it until it comes along. I just see him as a guy that is going to be a solid, you know, either fifth starter or seventh, eighth man in the NBA that makes good money throughout the rest of his career. It's just like a no-brainer almost to me, even despite the athleticism.
No, all his numbers look really impressive. Like, he averaged 18 points a game. He averaged, you know, 4 rebounds, 3 assists, a steal, you know, good percentages. Just, and everything that I've read about him shows that sort of, you know, defensive mentality, that commitment, that ability to work and improve. And that's obviously a key factor. And a lot of the times we'll look at numbers, or people look at numbers and look at that exclusively. But so much of basketball and the NBA goes into personality and drive and all that sort of stuff. And you know, from what you're saying, it backs up a lot of the things that I've seen about him as well. We talked Luwawu, we talked Brogdon. Who are some other 3-and-D prospects that you seem to like personally?
I would say that Torian Prince is an interesting one, because you're talking more of a 3-4 3-and-D as opposed to like your traditional wing 2-3 3-and-D. Prince is a guy who knocks down shots. He's one of the best per minute scorers in college basketball over the course of the last couple of seasons. In terms of, you have my big board up. Who else are you interested in? I'm trying to think off the top of my head and my brain is breaking.
We've got Beasley.
Malik Beasley is a guy that's more of a 1-2, not really a defender yet. Freshman, still trying to kind of figure things out, but he's really crafty. He's a little bit more athletic than you think he is, and can kind of do a lot of creation in terms of shooting from all over the floor and getting to the rim and getting out in transition. Another guy is actually a guy that I'm writing about for tomorrow on CBS is DeAndre Bembry. He doesn't really have the three part of that game, but he has the defense. He has the slashing ability, the creation ability. And he's a guy that's really team oriented, really passes the ball well, really does a lot on that side. Malachi Richardson's another wing that, you know, 7-foot wingspan, really quick, but played in that zone. So you have to question whether or not it's going to take him a little bit of time defensively, but he has all of the tools to be a good defender. It's just whether or not that's going to come along. And then teams trust his ability to shoot eventually coming along. Patrick McCaw, I think, is the guy that a lot of people are excited about in a 3-and-D capacity, because he can knock down catch and shoots as well as kind of create his own on offense. And he's a really good passer and he really does defend well. He was one of the best guys in the country last year at getting steals. In terms of, you know, just creating transition opportunities for his team. So I think that there are a lot of guys in this draft that do fit the 3-and-D mold. There are just a lot more questions about them in terms of how they'll continue to develop over the course of the next year or two.
Yeah, McCall was a guy that I was hoping that you'd bring up, because he's getting a lot of buzz at the moment about this sort of late round prospect who could really develop. And yeah, he averaged 2.5 steals per game last season, which is obviously, you know, tremendously high, and can pass the ball as well. I think he's got a ton of intrigue in that late first round, maybe early second round range. Sam, I reckon we're just about done here. That was a pretty very informative chat, so I thank you for coming on.
Yeah, no, anytime, Josh. Happy to do it.
Now, just now,
especially for my bearded brethren. I mean, that's the most important part here. I mean, you got to get guys that are bearded. We got to stick together, man.
Of course, and people who follow Australian football and dabble in the NBA as well. We've got to cover those bases both ways. Now, Sam, you've got your mock draft and you've got your big board over on CBS Sports. And you mentioned you've got an article coming out in the next couple of days.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing stuff nonstop at this point. I mean, I've got my NBA draft big board and notebook column coming tomorrow morning. On Sunday, I think I have a feature coming on Isaiah Cordonnier. And then next week, I have about a million things posted. So just go to CBS Sports. I'm sure you'll find me somewhere on there.
And if I'm sure everyone is already following you on Twitter, but if they're not, where can they find you on Twitter?
Sam_Vecenie. So Sam_Vecenie. I'm relatively easy to find, and I'm just so sorry for my Twitter account being fairly obnoxious and going in 45 different directions all at once, especially during hockey season. So my apologies in advance.
That's what Twitter's designed for being obnoxious and going in different directions. That's their mission statement, I believe.
Right. Oh yeah, I believe it.
Thank you, Sam. It was great to chat to you. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Obviously, if you want to hear more of these episodes, you can subscribe on iTunes, you can subscribe on YouTube, and always giving a rating or a review or a thumbs up on YouTube helps tremendously in getting the program out to more people and showing your support for everything that we're doing over here. You can follow me on Twitter at @redrock_beeble, which I do encourage that you do. That would be fantastic. We are done. Sam, once again, thank you, and we'll chat soon.
Yeah, absolutely, Josh. Had a great time.
No problem. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Oops. Hey, my music never works at the end. Let's try again. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya.